Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Then There Were Two, a History of the World series. I'm Jeffrey Clark, being joined virtually by Lucas Mitzel. Lucas, this is one of those episodes that we have looked forward to doing, but at the same time have not looked forward to doing because it is taking place against a tragic backdrop. And while this particular World Series is not affected by what the reason for this tragic backdrop is, it nonetheless plays an important role in the season for one of our combatants.
It absolutely does, as we talked a lot in our 2001 episode about the Yankees and, to a lesser degree, the Mets kind of picking up the city of New York on a micro level and the country on the macro level in a tough time. And we get pretty much the exact same situation here in 2013, to the point where you and I actually did a little bit of additional, I guess, research in preparation for this episode.
Yeah, we did. But before we get to that, let's go back a little bit further for how these 2013 Boston Red Sox were built. They were destined for a last place finish in 2012, so right before the waiver trade deadline, back when that was still a thing, they traded a whole bunch of notable names to the Dodgers in an attempt to shake up their clubhouse culture. That consisted of Carl Crawford, Josh Beckett, Adrian Gonzalez, Nick Punto, and Cash. And this is, again, a big deal because we all know from our formative years that these are all, maybe with the exception of Punto, really influential names in baseball. So I'm sure a lot of people were thinking, well, we have these big names, but they're not getting the job done. So we have to do something about this. And to drive the point home further, they named their former pitching coach, John Farrell, as their first-year manager. And everybody is thinking, well, okay, they still have some talented players around, some guys who have won championships here, but what can they really do? And they get off to a pretty decent start, culminating with a walk-off win on the regional holiday known as Patriots Day. But it is after that walk-off win against the Rays where everything changes, not just for the Red Sox, but for the entire city of Boston and pretty much its entire history moving forward.
Circling back just a moment, and we're going to get to all of this here in a moment. I find it funny that you bring up Nick Punto as not necessarily being influential, as though you and I didn't work with somebody at WONC who wanted to rename the Mendoza line the Punto line, but that's neither here nor there. I do like that you brought up the whole Red Sox culture thing, because this Red Sox franchise is only about a season or two removed from the beer and chicken possibly fueled collapse right at the end of 2011, where they were up something like 7 games in September and fell apart and resulted in that crazy final night, game 162, that saw the Red Sox get walked off in Baltimore, and literally a minute later, Evan Longoria hit the walk-off home run that propelled the Rays to the 2011 American League wild card. So that whole culture thing does kind of help prompt that 2012 trade, but there are still a fair number of pieces from prior Red Sox runs on this 2013 squad that has the walk-off win on April 15th, 2013, and Boston, at least for a moment, seems to be in a good place.
So what happens after the walk-off win, and what I just alluded to, is that it being Patriots Day, the Boston Marathon is going on, a very proud sports tradition where people from all over the world come to compete, but it is really the highlight of a very important day for people in the New England area. Well after the elite runners have crossed the finish line, when the everyday people are crossing the finish line, so people are actually interested in seeing their friends and loved ones crossing the finish line, we get one and then a second explosion, and people are scattered about. Some people are literally scattered about because these explosions cost them some body parts. And a few of them even lose their lives, including an 8-year-old boy. And pretty much for the first time since 9/11, we have a major terrorist act on U.S. soil, and during what's supposed to be a celebratory day at that.
Yeah, and so, you know, kind of circling back again to, you know, in preparation for this, just to kind of get in the spirit of things, you and I, independent of each other, although kind of conferring via text a little bit, we watched the movie Patriots Day starring Mark Wahlberg. And now, I had never seen it prior to our lead up for this episode, and it's I think you had mentioned in a prior episode something about watching Titanic and each time hoping that the ship doesn't hit the iceberg. And it was a similar feeling with watching this movie of, you know what's coming, but you're hoping against hope that those bombs do not go off on Boylston Street.
Well, unfortunately, they do go off. And you get some great performances from Kevin Bacon, John Goodman in supporting roles as well, not to mention J.K. Simmons and Rachel Brosnahan. Before she was on one of my wife's favorite shows, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, was on a supporting role. She played one of the victims who lost her legs. And this movie, I won't go into too many details about it, but it's basically about how the first responders, the FBI, worked together, the government leaders as well, to find the two gentlemen, I guess you could say, who were responsible for these bombings. And unfortunately, the movie also portrays them executing an MIT police officer. And then you have them carjacking an unsuspecting person. That person is able to escape when they're at a gas station. And one of them ends up dead. The other is still on death row as of this recording because he is captured after hiding out in a boat after the entire city of Boston, the surrounding communities, are put into a shelter-in-place order right before shelter-in-place was a thing during another crisis that would come about several years after this. But this was a movie that really embraced the spirit of the city of Boston, everyone surrounding it. Of course, Mark Wahlberg was one of the producers of this movie, and rightfully so. He is one of the really proud Bostonians out there in Hollywood, and probably nobody is able to publicly state the spirit of Boston better than one Mr. David Ortiz.
I alluded to this at the end of our 2012 episode. You know, throughout the course of the podcast, like, I would say we've probably earned, if this were an MPAA rating system, I mean, we might trend a little bit more PG-13. Like, we haven't been, you know, risque or really out there with a lot of stuff, but it's just collectively, I would say we're probably at that level. But as such, if we are allowed to be PG-13, we get to do this once and only once. And if we're going to use it anywhere, it has to be here. And so in the Red Sox first game back at Fenway following the win on Patriot Day, we have a whole big pregame ceremony, and you know, first responders are out on the field and they make a big thing of it. And finally at the end, David Ortiz gets up with a microphone and, you know, trying to get the crowd going a little bit. This jersey that we wear today, it doesn't say Red Sox as it normally would. It's a Boston. Gets the cheers going from that. Thanks Mayor Menino and Governor Patrick, the public figures in charge of the city of Boston, Massachusetts, and thanks the first responders. And then the greatest line that he could have possibly come up with: this is our fucking city, and no one is going to dictate our freedom. Stay strong. And I use it, A, for historical accuracy, but B, him just saying this is our city, like, yeah, there's a degree of power to it, but there's a time and a place for using language like that, and this was the perfect setting for it.
Well, the same, I think I'm going to have to mark this episode explicit, and I apologize to you for that, Lucas, but it is worth noting that the FCC chose not to censor NESN for this because of the circumstances surrounding it. And, of course, Ortiz was able to replicate his speech at the end of Patriots Day. And it's great how he didn't really change anything from when he made that speech initially. So the Boston Strong mantra is born. And I just remember right before all this happened in real life that I was coming home from work one night, and when the manhunt was going on, somebody had posted online somewhere the Boston police scanner, and I couldn't quite understand what was going on, so I don't know if I actually heard anything, but I remember a lot of people were listening to that. Also, just going back to Ortiz's speech, it's been a little less than a year since I made my first trek to Fenway Park to cover the ALS game between Boston College and Notre Dame. When I was in the cafeteria type area reserved for the media, they had various photos from Red Sox history all over the place. I mean, not just there, but all over the media level. And one of the photos there is of Ortiz making this speech. And I was like, I have to send this to Lucas because he's going to love it. So I did. And you texted back, whoever said you can't hear pictures is a liar or something to that effect.
I'm pretty sure that's exactly what I said, because there's a fairly common meme out there of, you know, like a student in class saying, I can hear pictures, the teacher saying back, you can't hear pictures. And then the picture is something that you associate with a certain sound. And, you know, obviously the picture of Ortiz talking, you immediately go to the speech and everything kind of comes flooding back. And this kind of served as, to some degree, a rallying cry for the city of Boston, as in addition to the Red Sox trying to help heal the city, you have a weird lockout related season, but the Boston Bruins on the hockey side ended up helping heal the city as well, as they were able to go on a magical playoff run. They have that comeback from down 4-1 against the Maple Leafs, which, yes, there's an asterisk that it's the Maple Leafs, but that third period there and the eventual overtime win helps set the stage for a run to the Stanley Cup final, where it comes to a screeching halt in 17 seconds. But this is then there were two a history of the World Series, not then there were two a history of the Stanley Cup final.
Right, so we have all of this in the background of the rest of this season. The Red Sox really come together after the Boston Marathon bombing. Like I said, the Boston Strong mantra is born. They begin the season with a league best 18-8, and they end up being in first place for 158 days, never losing more than three straight games. The other thing that really made this team stand out, other than David Ortiz winning the Silver Slugger Award and leading the American League in intentional walks, and Shane Victorino leading in hit by pitch and winning a Gold Glove, is the fact that beards are the name of the game for this team, to the point where they have beard handshakes, and that's exactly how it sounds. And the teammate statue outside Fenway Park now has beards on all four players. The teammate statue is, of course, a tribute to the Red Sox players who fought during World War II. And John Farrell, being the clean-shaven man he is, prompts Bob Costas in a clip on the World Series film to say, Farrell looks like he walked off the set of Mad Men to manage the cast of Duck Dynasty. And I love that so much.
I mean, it's a very 2013 reference, but it absolutely fits.
So the Red Sox are able to get to the World Series, mainly after Ortiz hits a big grand slam to tie game two of the ALCS, already down 1-0, in which Torrey Hunter disappears over the wall. And the Red Sox just kind of take it to the Tigers from there in the ALCS. But they also had to contend with a tough Rays team in the ALDS. So they're in the World Series. Now we finally get to our National League combatants, only a couple of years removed from winning the World Series, the St. Louis Cardinals. They have Adam Wainwright, who could not pitch in 2011. He ends up leading the National League with five complete games, and he ties for the NL lead with 19 wins. They tie for the best fielding percentage in the National League, .988. They get a Silver Slugger Award and Gold Glove from Yadier Molina. You have Matt Carpenter leading the National League in hits and runs, also winning a Silver Slugger Award. And Carlos Beltran has his first World Series after 2,064 regular season games with five teams over 16 seasons. They win 97 games along with the Red Sox, but the Red Sox get home field advantage by virtue of the AL winning the All-Star game. But regardless of what happened with the Red Sox, the Cardinals were no less impressive in 2013.
No, absolutely not. This is a rare year in the playoff format that we have. We're in the second year of the wild card game, and this was the fun one of the Pirates-Reds game with Johnny Cueto dropping the ball as the Pirates fans chant his name, and then he immediately gives up a home run right off of that. But it's the rare instance here of both of these teams were the top seeds in their respective leagues. We mentioned the exactly matching records, and so on paper, this should be a really good one.
It should, and especially because of the Cardinals' rotation. It's a very young rotation at that. You have Michael Wacha, who was 22, Carlos Martinez, 22, Trevor Rosenthal, 23, Kevin Segrist, 24, Seth Maness, 25. They also had Joe Kelly, age 25, and Lance Lynn, whom we remember from a couple episodes back, 26. So you have a really talented rotation that is also really young. And youth will really play into the role of a World Series team that you're really looking forward to in a few weeks. But for the moment, the Cardinals have a young rotation that's pacing a lineup filled with a bunch of veterans. And that's always a really unique feeling when you have young arms lifting up veteran bats.
It kind of seems to be the Cardinals' MO. They know how to reload. You know, they're a couple years removed from Albert Pujols departing free agency. We mentioned that. And yet, this is their third straight year of at least making the National League Championship Series. It's their second trip to the World Series in 3 years. They're just a couple years removed from that title. They have guys who were on the team that won it all in 2011. The Red Sox still have some carryover of guys as well, and it's a good balance really both ways between the youth and the experience.
And those young arms are really going to have to prepare to work against the Red Sox, because the Red Sox saw 158.3 pitches per game. That is the most pitches seen by any team this year, and they are definitely trying to make the most out of their sluggers. It is a far cry from the 2012 Giants, who won the previous year's World Series. They were the first team since the 82 Cardinals to win the World Series, despite finishing last in home runs. The Red Sox are filled with sluggers, so again, the Cardinals are going to have to do what it takes to shut down this Red Sox lineup. And Game 1 doesn't really start out that way. Jacoby Ellsbury, who led the American League in stolen bases, walks to lead off the first inning. He later moves to second on a Pedroia single. And the Cardinals, whom, again, tied for the NL lead in fielding percentage during the regular season, are really put in a tough spot here. They shift the infield because shifting is still allowed during this era. David Ortiz hits it to a fielder's choice. Pedroia is initially called out at second by umpire Daniel DeMuth. Yeah, he says Pete Cosma only dropped a throw from Carpenter at second on a transfer. John Farrell comes out to protest this. And if I remember correctly, this was when Joe Buck and Tim McCarver were like, "Oh, I don't think so." Or McCarver's like, "I don't think so, Joe." And Buck's like, "I don't either." And McCarver's working his final World Series, by the way. Thanks be to God. The call is reversed and changed to a fielder's choice E6 after the umpires huddle to discuss the play. And remember, we're still 1 year away from instant replay being instituted in Major League Baseball. So this is really, if you think about it, the last instance in which umpires are huddling together like this for a consequential game, because starting next year, they will have the benefit of instant replay. But for the moment, they have to still get together and discuss this. And this turns out to really hurt, because the bases are loaded and Mike Napoli, who previously faced the Cardinals in the 2011 series for the Rangers and drove in 10 runs while also posting a 1.164 OPS, hits a bases-clearing double. So a very controversial play ends up costing the Cardinals dearly.
You have to give credit to the umpiring crew for getting together and realizing that there was no transfer and that Cosma never had clear control of the ball, rule him safe. And ultimately, I mean, this probably would have then been a potential 2-run double instead of a 3-run double, as ended up being the case. But as it is here, you have the Red Sox doing what they do and getting out to a pretty sizable lead early.
And things go from bad to worse for the Cardinals in the second inning. Leading off the second, Stephen Drew reaches first on infield single after a pop fly drops between Adam Wainwright and Yadier Molina. And Lucas, you have an evil grin on your face, I can see right now.
I didn't remember the exact context of this play, but it's one that I've seen pop up occasionally on, you know, like Best Fans St. Louis or somewhere like that, of given exactly who was involved in this and Yadi having the reputation that he does and Wainwright, you know, I guess kind of similar thing there of there is absolutely no way this ball should have dropped in. But it did, and kind of the reactions of both on the play as it happens, really just chef's kiss.
And then one of the guys that you're really looking forward to in that future episode I alluded to, David Ross, moves Drew to second on a single, and the bases are loaded when Cosma makes an error on a Shane Victorino grounder to short. Pedroia scores Drew on an RBI single. Ortiz scores Ross on a sac fly to right that nearly goes for a grand slam, but Beltran brings the ball back for a robbery. But it ends up costly for Beltran because he has to exit with a bruised chest as a result of that play. The The Cardinals do have some chances here. They load the bases with one out in the fourth, but John Lester, another guy you're looking forward to talking about, although we have talked about him before on this podcast, induces a 1-2-3 double play from David Freese, so Freese's magic from 2011 is non-existent here. With two outs in the second inning, Pedroia reaches on an errant throw by Freese at third. So again, Freese is not the World Series hero from a couple of years ago. So Segrist relieves Maness, but Ortiz homers to right center on the first pitch. That is his 16th playoff home run. Lester ends up striking out 8, walking 1, and allowing 5 hits over 7 2/3 shutout innings and 112 pitches. By the ninth inning, the Red Sox are up big enough that they decide to summon Ryan Dempster to pitch the final inning of his career. He had thrown 2,387 regular season innings over 16 seasons with 5 teams. He pitched for the Cubs for 9 seasons. The Red Sox win this one 8-1. Dempster does not do anything except do his job enough to close the win out. I'd say it's a damn fine way for him to go out.
Yeah, I mean, other than giving up the leadoff home run in the top of the ninth to Matt Holliday to spoil the shutout, which, I mean, again, this is the very end of Ryan Dempster's career, but he goes through and induces fly out from Alan Craig, pop out from Yachty, and then after a two-out single by Freese, he strikes out Matt Adams swinging to end it. So, heck of a way for Dempster to go out. He was somebody I enjoyed on the Cubs for as long as he was there, and I mean, he continues to be a fan favorite on the north side of Chicago. So, I'm glad that he was able to get that. Also, let's note here for future reference, Kevin Segrist against lefties in the playoffs, probably not ideal.
Were you getting emotional as you're watching this part in the World Series film?
Honestly, yes, I was a little bit. In 2013, like, Dempster was the only guy that I really had an emotional tie to. Now, obviously, you've alluded to multiple other instances of guys that I will get emotionally connected to in the future. But yeah, no, absolutely, I was emotional watching the World Series film in preparation for this episode.
Looking ahead to Game 2, we have several 2004 Red Sox players who aren't active anymore hanging out David Ortiz as he is hitting in the batting cage before Game 2. And Ortiz is really focused because Michael Wacha, who is a rookie at this point, is entering with a 3-0 record and a .43 ERA in the playoffs. The game is scoreless through 3 innings, but then Matt Holliday leads off the 4th with a triple. He later scores on an RBI groundout by Molina. Pedroia walks with 1 out in the 6th. He promptly scores on Ortiz, 2-run homer to left center during an at-bat in which Wacha throws nothing but changeups. Ortiz becomes the first Red Sox player to homer in games 1 and 2 of a World Series. And then with 1 out in the 7th inning, Freese walks, John Jay singles. That prompts Craig Breslow to relieve John Lackey, who struck out 6 and walked 2 over 6 at 3rd innings. Another guy you'll be looking forward to in the future, Lucas, even though this is not the first time we've brought him up. Cosma pinch runs for Freese, and he and Jay execute a double steal before Daniel Descalso walks to load the bases. Cosma scores the tying run on a Carpenter sack fly. Then Jared Seltzer-Lamacchia mishandles the Johnny Gomes throw from left. And then Breslow throws the ball away trying to get Jay at third, so Jay scores the go-ahead run. Beltran scores Descalso on RBI single after there were doubts about his availability from a Game 1 injury. Martinez and Rosenthal shout the Red Sox over the final 3 innings to give Wacha a win. The Cardinals tie this series with a 4-2 victory. Wacha, meanwhile, has an incredible playoffs to this point. He is now 4-0, and he has an ERA of 1. He has struck out 28 over 27 innings. So you can't say Wacha didn't earn this win. He's the youngest pitcher ever to win 4 starts in 1 postseason.
And his only blemish here in this one was giving up that 2-run home run to David Ortiz, which completely understandable in the circumstances of things. The Cardinals win in a way that they seem to a lot of the time as they, you know, put together a little something and then the devil magic comes to play. If you get the tie on the sacrifice fly and the other runners advancing on the Seltzer-Lamacchia error and then Breslow backing it up. And while I get what he was trying to do, if you just hold on to the ball, it's entirely possible here that you're able to get out of the inning with things still tied. Instead, he throws it away. That results in a couple more runs scoring and the Cardinals even the series. This is the first World Series loss by the Red Sox since Game 7 of 1986 that snaps a 9-game win streak.
So we go to St. Louis for a Game 3. Starting for the Red Sox in this game is Jake Peavy, who was acquired from the White Sox at the trade deadline. The White Sox had a tough season that year. They end up losing 99 games. This is Peavy's first World Series appearance after 1,945 regular season innings pitched over 12 seasons. He gets a rude awakening when Matt Carpenter leads off the first with a single. He moves to second on a Beltran sack bunt. He scores on a Holiday single. Then Holiday scores on back-to-back singles from Matt Adams and Molina. The Cardinals then load the bases with no outs in the fourth, but Peavy strikes out Cosma and induces two pop-ups to escape the jam. Xander Bogaerts triples for the Red Sox to lead off the fifth. Sal Macchio walks. He is later forced out when Mike Karp hits a ground ball when he's pinching for Peavy, but that allows Bogaerts to score. Then Victorio walks to lead off the sixth. He later scores the tying run on a Daniel Nava RBI single. Breswell enters into the seventh, and he promptly gives up an infield single to Carpenter, and he hits Beltran. So he is relieved by Junichi Tozawa, and both runners promptly score on a Holiday RBI double. Then Ellsbury singles to lead off the eighth. Victorino is hit by a pitch. Both runners advance on Pedroia groundouts, and then Ortiz is intentionally walked to load the bases, and understandably so, you don't want him beating you. Then Rosenthal relieves Martinez. Nava scores Ellsbury on a force out to second. And then Victorino scores on a Bogaerts infield single to Cosma. So the Red Sox are in pretty good shape here in Game 3. Koji Uehara comes in to relieve Brandon Workman. And Uehara had an incredible regular season for the Red Sox. He emerged as the closer. He did not allow an earned run in 31 games from July 2nd through September 13th. So, obviously, Red Sox Nation is feeling pretty good right now. But then Molina singles with one out. So, Alan Craig pinch hits for Rosenthal and doubles, moving Molina to third. And then, probably the most chaotic ending to a World Series game of all time.
Oh, 100%.
So, try to follow me here if you can. John Jay is the batter. He grounds to second base. Pedroia throws Molina out at home, even though there's not a force play. But obviously, you want to try and keep the game tied there. And then Sal Macchio throws to third, trying to get Craig. But Will Middlebrooks has trouble receiving the throw, and the ball gets away, which happens a lot. So there's nothing that out of the ordinary about it. But then Middlebrooks instinctively gets up to look for the ball, which, again, not out of the ordinary. But in doing so, he unwittingly interferes with Craig as Craig is trying to score. And third base umpire Jim Joyce, who, by the way, is only 3 years removed from robbing Armando Galarraga of a perfect game in Detroit, but that is a topic for a different podcast. He sees this, and somehow the Red Sox are able to throw Craig out at the plate, but Jim Joyce says no because he sees the obstruction by Middlebrooks on Craig. So Craig is awarded home plate. The Cardinals get the win 5-4 as a result of this play. And while this might not completely vindicate Jim Joyce's role in the imperfect game from 3 years earlier, I would say that he did a good job working towards redeeming himself here.
Circling back to 2010, in Joyce's defense, in the immediate aftermath of that, he realized his mistake, owned up to it, and you had the next day of Galarraga bringing out the lineup card and them exchanging pleasantries, and everything was okay. And we actually get Jim Joyce on the World Series film talking about this play, and you know, he kind of mentions exactly what we said of he saw the collision following the play, and he said he immediately had obstruction, and it fits the definition according to the MLB rules. Obstruction describes an act by a fielder who is not in possession of the ball or in the process of fielding it that impedes the base runner's progress. Now, because the ball has long since passed him by when the contact occurs, by the letter of the rule, yeah, this is obstruction, and, you know, the play is being made on the obstructed base runner in this instance, so the ball is ruled dead, and the umpire can place all runners on the base that he determines they would have reached without the obstruction, in this case, granting him home plate, which, again, despite the arguments of John Farrell and company, I think this is the right call.
I think so, too, and I remember watching this in the newsroom at the Tribune thinking, yeah, you have to award home plate right there. There's no question about it. And I feel bad for Middlebrooks here because he was just calling the wrong place at the wrong time. I think any third baseman in the same situation would have done the same thing. You're both trying to accomplish a goal for your team, and it just so happened that these two bodies collided during a very consequential moment because now the Cardinals have 2-1 lead. And this overshadows something that you will appreciate, Lucas. Because this game is being played under National League rules, no DH, Farrell and Mike Matheny end up using 35 players, including 12 pitchers. That is a World Series record for a 9-inning game. 15 players hit in the 9th spot in the batting orders. There are 5 pinch hitters used. Farrell would probably regret later, as Tom Verducci would write in Sports Illustrated, that he did not make a double switch in the 8th inning. But the two teams have only 4 extra base hits during this game. None of them are home runs. Both Ortiz and Beltran are intentionally walked in the 8th inning. And it's just crazy how these little things that would otherwise get attention don't get attention because everyone's talking about the first series game ever to end on an obstruction call.
Yeah, no, I look at the box score on Baseball Reference and I look at all of the fill-ins for things and just try to imagine how messy my scorecard would be. And yeah, it would have been an absolute disaster. So that is the one thing that I'm glad about with the Universal DH now.
We move on to game 4. David Ortiz singles off Lance Lynn for an infield single to lead off the second. Fortunately, Lynn is okay. And it doesn't matter because Johnny Gomes promptly hits it to a 5-4-3 double play. With one out in the 3rd inning, Matt Carpenter singles and then moves to second on Ellsbury error in center. Beltran scores Carpenter on RBI single. Ortiz doubles to lead off the 5th inning. He moves to 3rd on back-to-back walks from Gomes and Bogarts. He scores on a sac fly from Drew. And then for the 2nd straight week, we have a motivational speech highlighted in the dugout. David Ortiz decides this is the time to motivate his guys. So just like Hunter Pence with the Giants the season before, David Ortiz gets his guys together.
Yeah, no, and just manages to strike the right tone and say the right things and gets his team rallying. And they do here in the top of the 6th after Ellsbury pops out and Daniel Nava grounds out. They get a little two-out magic going. Dustin Pedroia singles to center with 2 outs off of Lance Lynn, the Game 4 starter for the Cardinals. And then Ortiz himself ends up walking. At this point, Lance Lynn is yanked from the game. Seth Maness comes in as Johnny Gomes steps to the plate.
Yes, and Gomes was not even supposed to be in the lineup, but Shane Victorino was a late scratch. And he hits a 3-run homer to left center. That is his first hit of the series. This inning, by the way, was sandwiched between 2 perfect innings from Felix Dubron, who had entered for Clay Buchholz in the 5th inning. By the way, what is it about motivational speeches to World Series teams in the 2010s? And I have a feeling this is not the last we are going to hear about these things.
No, it is not.
Back to this game, John Lackey enters in the 8th inning to pitch a scoreless inning. Uehara does likewise in the 9th inning. And he does so on another first to end a World Series game. Colton Wong is pinch running for Alan Craig after Craig singles with 1 out. And then with 2 outs, Beltran is at the plate. And Uehara proceeds to pick Wong off of first. Wong becomes the first player ever to be picked off to end a World Series game. So the Red Sox win this one 4-2. And the only thing I could compare this to was way back in the 70s when Herb Washington, the designated runner for the A's, got picked off at a crucial spot in a World Series game at Dodger Stadium. Now, granted, the A's ended up winning that series, but I couldn't help but think of the parallels here, even though the designated runner was, by all accounts, a failed experiment by the Charlie Finley A's teams of the 70s.
I enjoy a good Herb Washington callback, though, honestly. And it's kind of fitting, too, that you have Tim McCarver on the call here for a pickoff at first, as he will be in a future game in his role as Cardinals color commentator during the John Lester yips throwing to first era that was ended on a similar play.
And these teams are very close to each other, so it's only fitting that it goes to a best of 3, because for 26 of the 27 innings in games 2, 3, and 4, no more than 2 runs ever separated the two teams, and all those games were decided by 1 play. So you really don't know what's going to happen as we move into game 5. Ortiz enters game 5 with the highest World Series batting average for a career for batters with at least 50 play appearances. He's also leading the Red Sox with a 727 batting average, while the rest of the team is hitting a paltry 138. Pedroia and Ortiz hit back-to-back doubles with 1 out in the 1st inning. And that is somewhat controversial because some are critical of Adam Wainwright's decision to pitch to Ortiz with first base open and a runner on second base. And I would say it is justified, because Ortiz leads off the 4th with a single that improves his series average to 769. And that ties a World Series record by reaching base his 9th consecutive time. But Gomes flies out and now it hits to a 4-6-3 double play, so that ends up not hurting the Cardinals. And then with one out in the fourth inning, Halliday hits a game-tying solo homer to left center. That tags John Lester with his first career World Series run in 16 2/3 innings over 3 games. Beltran just misses a home run to left. Then Molina is robbed of a line drive base hit on a tough catch by Drew at short. Then with one out in the seventh inning, Bogart singles. Drew walks. Ross scores Bogart's on a ground rule double that just stays fair. Ellsbury later scores Drew on an RBI single, but Ross is thrown out at the plate. And this is just tough luck for Adam Wainwright because he strikes out 10 and walks 1 over 7 innings. But Lester's just a little bit better. He strikes out 7, walks nobody, and gives up 4 hits over 7 2/3 innings. Then Uehara retires the final 4 batters for the save. So the Red Sox get to go to Fenway Park after a 3-1 win with a chance to clinch there.
I guess to some degree in Wainwright's defense, if you want to play devil's advocate a little bit, in that first inning with first base open, I would probably say that yes, he should have intentionally walked David Ortiz given the circumstances of what was going on. But in his defense, those back-to-back doubles are sandwiched between Wainwright's first 6 outs that he records are all strikeouts. He gets 3 looking in the first inning and then strikes out Bogarts, Drew, and Ross all swinging in the second inning to get things going really strong. And you mentioned 10 strikeouts for the game. And to some degree, yeah, kind of a tough luck loss. Although, you know, you have David Ross, who has been struggling and struck out a bunch in this series, who comes up with a huge hit, just barely fair, bouncing in, and is able to give the Red Sox the lead. Ellsbury with the insurance, Uehara able to slam the door, and we go back to Boston.
And I know it's probably a bummer that David Ross was thrown out at home, but you gotta give credit to Shane Robinson for that assist to get the Cardinals out of further trouble. And it's just unfortunate that it was in vain, but impressive play nonetheless. So we go to Game 6, and the Red Sox have a chance to clinch the World Series at Fenway Park for the first time since 1918. And if you'll recall, during the 1918 World Series, it was not a celebratory World Series in the least because the U.S. was fully engulfed in World War I at that point, and the season had come to an early end because of the worker fight order that had been passed down. And by all accounts, that was just not a well-played World Series, and there was a lot of stuff off the field that was causing problems. And by the time the Red Sox clinched the World Series at Fenway Park, it was a little more than polite applause from that crowd because, again, they could care less about baseball with the men fighting overseas in World War I. But there is not that backdrop this time around, so Red Sox fans, I would say, are ready for a party.
Yeah, no, and especially, too, given, you know, you had the win in 04 was sweet, but it came in St. Louis. The win in 07 was certainly sweet as well, but that came in Denver. Here you've got a chance in front of your 38,447 absolutely rabid fans to finally be able to celebrate the title with you, and they just need a good performance from starting pitcher John Lackey as he goes up against Michael Wacha.
Yeah, Wacha, as we have already mentioned, has been dominant during these playoffs, so you would think that the Cardinals are a slight favorite given the matchup here, especially since Wacha already outdueled Lackey in Game 2. But then in the third inning, Ellsbury singles to lead off. He moves to second on Pedroia, ground out to third. Ortiz is intentionally walked, which, you know, he's hitting 733 at this point in the series, so why take that chance? Napoli strikes out, and then Gomes is hit by a pitch to load the bases. And then Victorino comes up, and we get a really cool moment in the World Series film where he is walking up to his song, Three Little Birds, and the entire Fenway Park crowd is singing along to it because by this point, he has become a cult figure in Red Sox Nation just for walking up to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's reminiscent to kind of the clapping that was done with walk-up music by Cubs in a future season. And Victorino hits an absolute missile to left.
Before I talk about this missile, it's just really cool to just hear after music cuts out the entire crowd going, every little thing gonna be all right.
I absolutely loved that.
If that was in a movie, I think it would just be perfect.
100%.
So anyway, after we get this really cool moment, Victorino hits a bases-clearing double off of the Green Monster. And the Fenway Park crowd obviously is up for grabs at that point. Especially after Steven Drew leads off the fourth with a home run to the Red Sox bullpen in right center. And then Ellsbury doubles with one out. He moves to third on a Pedroia flyout to right. Walker intentionally walks Ortiz. He is promptly relieved by Lance Lynn, who promptly gives up an RBI single to Napoli, a walk to Gomes, an RBI single to Victorino, who sets a playoff record for most 4 RBI games in the postseason. So no hits or RBIs for Victorino going into this game, and he does it all at the best possible moment. Mass relieves Lynn, and at that point, it's obvious to everybody that the Red Sox are going to win this. Yeah, especially after John Lack gives up one run, one walk, while striking out 5 on 105 pitches over 6 2/3 innings. Tozawa does enter with the bases loaded and 2 outs in the 7th with one run already in. He does induce a 3-1 ground out by Alan Craig. And then Workman Uehara foul with perfect innings to clinch the series. This is the 3rd World Series championship in 10 years for the Red Sox, and their 8th overall, the 4th most. John Lackey becomes the 7th pitcher to start and win multiple World Series clinchers after he did this with the Angels in 2002. And again, a party at Fenway Park 95 years in the making.
Yeah, no, and just the absolute joy in the crowd that you get from that is, this is probably one of the sweeter titles in the 21st century for the Red Sox, of like, yeah, you have that relief of finally breaking through in 2004. And, you know, we had talked in the 2007 episode about the 2004 title was for the fathers, the 2007 title was for the sons. This one is for the entire city of Boston, the city that rallied behind this team in a time when they needed something to lift their spirits, and this team absolutely did it.
We'll get more into that in just a bit, but let's consider David Ortiz. He ends up hitting .688 and has a .760 on base percentage. Both of those are the 2nd best in World Series history. And rounding that out is a 1.188 slugging percentage. So his OPS is nearly 2,000, but he'll sell for 1,948. No question about it, he is your World Series MVP.
The numbers speak for themselves, especially given that the Red Sox as a team hit just .211 for the series. The only other regulars to hit above the Mendoza line are Xander Bogaerts at .238. And Dustin Pedroia at .208. Jacoby Ellsbury did hit .250 for the series, so there were a handful of guys that were doing things elsewhere, but by and large, Ortiz was the Red Sox offense. Now, to the Red Sox credit, their pitching staff does a really good job. John Lackey goes 1-1, posts a .257 ERA. You could have maybe made an argument for John Lester going 2-0 with an ERA of .059 and striking out 15 batters over 15 and a third innings. Felix Dubron did a good job in relief, had a 1.93 ERA and just shy of 5 innings of work. Koji Uehara with 2 saves, an ERA of 0 for the series. Junichi Tozawa, Brandon Workman, also with ERAs of 0 in relief. Clay Buchholz had a no decision, but pitched 4 innings, did not allow an earned run. There's good numbers there. If you were going to give it to anybody else, it would maybe be Lester, but Ortiz's numbers are just so gaudy that you have to give him the award here.
The Red Sox have a 1.84 ERA in this World Series. That's just really interesting how in back-to-back years we have a World Series MVP on the hitting side when in fact it was the pitching side that really made the difference. We saw it with the Giants last year and now we're seeing it again. Just goes to show you that your entire staff can get the job done, but if somebody in your lineup is just playing otherworldly, then they are the ones who are going home with the World Series hardware. And I'm going to refer to it as something else in our next episode, but I'll save that for then because I'm really looking forward to that. But for the moment, I'll just say that David Ortiz is going home with a new car and a trophy and all that fun stuff. Not that he needed all that, honestly, because he was already a household name at that point and was well on his way to the Hall of Fame. But still, it's another nice addition to his resume, as if there was any doubt at this point he was going to Cooperstown anyway.
Because this is his final appearance, we will bring this up. This is the third and final World Series that David Ortiz will appear in. Over the course of three World Series, playing in 14 games, Ortiz slashes 455, 576, 795 for a 1372 OPS between an 04, 07, and 13. He hits three home runs in the World Series, two of them here in 2013, drives in 14 runs, has 14 walks to five strikeouts. Now, granted, a lot of that is teams are seeing, nope, I don't want to deal with him, and are intentionally giving him the free pass. Four of those walks, by the way, officially of the intentional variety, also had six doubles, goes 20 of 44 in 59 plate appearances, and just, I mean, I don't know what else more you can say. And yeah, that slash line is heavily buoyed by this ridiculous 2013 World Series that he has, but still, this is really impressive. Even just looking back in 2007, he hit 333. In 2004, he hit 308.
As David Ross said, that's why we call him Cooperstown. He is a true superstar. Johnny Gomes had a quote to sum it all up. I don't think we put Boston on our back. I think we jumped on their back. They wouldn't let us quit. And as a symbol of this, while they are celebrating with their fans in Boston a few days after this World Series is completed, they placed the trophy at the Boston Marathon finish line with a Boston Strong jersey in the middle of the trophy. If that doesn't sum up the entire year for the city of Boston, I don't know what does.
No, absolutely it does. It's the perfect image to kind of encapsulate everything of the team and the city. Just kind of, I don't know that you'll find a combination that has really meshed better than this one.
Fortunately, the World Series film does end on a lighter note, where the credits mention all of the beers that the Red Sox had. So I feel like the World Series film had to end on something lighthearted.
It did, and I mean, it doesn't quite go to the same level as the Jimmy Rollins, Ryan Howard rap or the Hunter Pence impersonations that we got last year, but the gushing over Mike Napoli's beard comes pretty close.
Yeah, I love all the urban legends that they were saying during this. I heard there were people living in that thing, among other things, so I'm glad that they were able to get on Napoli, just like the 2012 Giants were able to get on Hunter Pence during the credits of the previous World Series film. That is it for 2013. Looking briefly ahead to 2014, the closest we are getting to a dynasty for the rest of this podcast makes an appearance once more. This team will try and add to its recent growing collection of commissioner's trophies, and they will play a team that we have not seen for quite some time. But they are a very serious threat to disrupt this dynasty in the making.
And this series will end with maybe one of the biggest what-ifs in World Series history. Tune in next week to find out what it is.
So for Lucas Smith, I'm Jeffrey Clark. Thanks for listening to our 2013 episode of Then There Were Two, A History of the World Series. Like us on Facebook, follow us on what is still Twitter to us, subscribe. We will see you next time.